Welcome to another episode of Gospel Entrepreneurs. And I'm really excited because we're talking with someone from Northern Ireland, which I have a special affinity to because my wife is from Northern Ireland. We're going to be talking to Philip Logan. And I'm sure you're going to be interested in this story because as an 8-year-old, everything was stacked against him, but he achieved some most amazing things in his life. So sit back, enjoy. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, I think. Yeah.
And you're sitting in a very nice spot in Northern Ireland, is that right?
That's right, yes. County Antrim. I was born here quite a number of years ago, brought up in a town called Ballyclare, and I was born into a Plymouth Brethren household.
And people may not know the Plymouth Brethren, but that's basically an independent fellowship of believers where the Bible was pretty central to everything they did, wasn't it, Philip?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I think someone said about the Plymouth Brethren, it was a great road to go down, but not such a good house to stay in. So that had been my experience. I'm so grateful for the foundations of faith that I learned in the Plymouth Brethren. My biggest problem was going from a state of unbelief to a state of belief. For me, was the big issue because I couldn't remember ever being an unbeliever. And so it was really difficult for me to come to faith if I'd never been an unbeliever. I struggled with that for quite a while at the age of about 8 years of age. And then I realized that the important thing was, what do I believe today?
And so you were eight, but obviously nurtured in the faith and kept the faith during that whole time. There was no massive rebellion that you did during that journey?
Oh, yes, there was. Yeah, there was plenty of rebellion. I think at university, there was rebellion and lots of questions, and there were members of the opposite sex. It was just, it was very difficult to walk the straight and narrow. Yeah, there was wanting to give up this faith. Wouldn't life be a lot easier without having to abide by the teachings of the Lord? Really? I thought, well, maybe it would be easier, but I was to find out that it wasn't. So I think sometimes we need to go right to the edge of the cliff and look over before we can pull ourselves back. And yet, all things work together for good for those that love the Lord. So perhaps enough said about that.
Then you moved from university and you got into architecture, didn't you? How did that happen?
I went to university to do architecture. My education coming up, I exhibited a degree of dyslexia and learning difficulties, I think. And by the age of about nine, life got really difficult. Up until that point, it was pretty good. And it was only then at primary school I realized I was, in fact, the slowest learner in the classroom because the primary school teacher, she was putting a lot of questions on the blackboard, the old blackboard with the chalk, and she was desperate to, I'd figured it out, she was desperate to go outside, cross the corridor into the playground area to have a few cigarettes and then come back in. So she would put enough questions on the blackboard to keep us quiet and out of trouble, and no one was allowed to start any of the questions until she'd finished, except Logan, of course, because he was the slowest in the classroom. And he was slower than everybody, and everybody laughed. And so I realized that I wasn't as sharp as I thought I was. That kind of put me in a bit of a place where I thought I wasn't going to do very good academically because I had been told I wasn't. So I got into secondary school and I found a few subjects I was interested in. I was very good at the art and technical drawing and enjoyed the sciences. So I started to excel in these areas that I was interested in. I showed an interest and I went to the technical college to do my A-levels because we weren't really streamed to do A-level maths and art and physics at the grammar school. So I had to go somewhere else to do my A-levels. And I had a mix of art and mathematics, which was absolutely suitable for architecture. And I'd been brought up in the building trades. My father was a plasterer and a builder. I could look at drawings and things like that. And I thought, well, maybe I could do this. I had an old woodwork teacher and he asked me, he was looking, asking us about our careers. And I said, I think I'd like to be an architect, but I'm not sure I have the wherewithal to be able to do that academically. Or the patience, it takes 7 years to qualify properly.
Yeah.
And there's a Bachelor of Science degree and there's a year of working. You go back and you do a postgraduate degree. So there's 5 years at university. So that's a bit of a heavy number. I was struggling with my dyslexia, but there was a desire to give it a go. And he said to me, son, he said, if you're interested in that, even if you aim for the sun and you miss, you might hit a star. And I thought that was really good. It was Michelangelo that said, the problem isn't that we aim too high and miss the target. It's often that we aim too low and we hit it. That was a bit of a turning point. And he encouraged me to have a go at it. And so I went off to the technical college to do art and mathematics, A-level and physics. Well, I got an A in the mock A-level for maths. 98% in mechanics, I remember. And I was feeling good that I wasn't really the slowest in the class. And that my maths teacher cross-examined me, asking if I'd seen the paper beforehand. And it was completely innocent. I really didn't understand what he meant. And then he reached the paper over to me and he said, I marked you very hard. But the problem was I didn't get such a good grade in the A-level because for 2 years, we'd been studying the wrong syllabus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So a bit of a shock. I was, in fact, the only one in the technical college that year, which included night class and everything, that passed it. So I would have got easily the grades to get in to go to Queen's University in Belfast, which would have been what I would have desired. It would have been closer to home. But instead, I took a year out and then I put Dundee University is my first choice. And they loved that idea. And they loved the idea of the maths and the arts. And I got in without an interview. So I really think, I know the Lord's hand was there.
You've done Dundee University, a bit of a background where everybody thought you were the slowest. And all of a sudden, God has transformed that and turned that around to the point where you built one of the most iconic skyscrapers ever built and employed hundreds of people. How did that happen?
A bit at a time, really. Walking with the Lord is playing the long game. I had a job in London and I had a friend who had taken a job in Saudi Arabia. I was beginning to acquire negative equity on the property market back in the day. And he'd got a job in Saudi and he was able to make a dent in his mortgage and repayment for his car and stuff like that. And I thought if I could get 2 years in somewhere like that, no income tax and no VAT, I'd get out of that negative equity bracket. So I applied to an agency to see if that would be possible. And I got a couple of interests. A lot of them didn't want me to go abroad because if you'd never been to Saudi Arabia or some of these places, the opportunities they felt were, shall we say, it was a bit risky. They didn't want to invest in someone and then find out they couldn't stand the lifestyle. But
yeah.
I got an envelope through the door one day and I picked it up and I thought, my goodness, I really felt this is it. This could be life-changing. And I opened it up and it was an interview for a place in the United Arab Emirates working for the British company Shanklin Cox Limited. I got a sense from the Lord that this could be life-changing. Difficult to put that into words, but that's what I felt. So I went for the interview and I did in fact get the job. And all of a sudden, within a month and a half, they had me on an aeroplane flying into Abu Dhabi. It wasn't an easy job. The boss that we had wasn't an easy chap. He always managed to keep the company above the bottom line, so I learned a great deal from him. I felt that it was a good place to stay. And I got involved in a church in the city of Al Ain. It's right there in the middle of the desert. And it was established by the Kennedys from the USA. It was a mission hospital, and it's still there today. I sort of made a bit of a home there. And within 7 years, I led the management buyout of the company, and I became the CEO of Shanklin Cox.
That's a pretty big statement. You led the management buyout. That sounds like a big project.
It took about 9 months. There was quite a lot to go through, and there was a lot of prayer, a lot of, this is crazy, this is madness. I met my wife, Rachel, out there, and we had two children. And was this the best thing to do? But I felt God's calling on it, because a bit like Moses, when he saw the Red Sea started to part, there was a few things that just opened up for me, and I just kept on moving forward. Yeah. But going back, I always had an entrepreneurial bent. Even at secondary school education, during the summer period, I bought one of these beauty block things out of Kay's catalogue, and I was manufacturing cement blocks for sale. Because my father was a contractor, and there was always bags of cement, and I used to work for him on the site, so I knew how to mix this stuff. I moved his car and everybody else's car out of what was a large garage and got a smooth floor, and I started pressing these concrete blocks, and I got some friends from school to, they thought this was a great idea. And so I had a good order book and I was producing a good product. And then the authorities would have come in and closed us down because we were all underage and we went back to school at the end of the summer period. But there was things like that I would have an eye to business.
So, Philip, you bought the company out, a management buyout. You've now got this company. I mean, that's probably a scary place to be, isn't it?
Terrifying. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And then in about maybe 2 or 3 years later, we bought out a sister company as well called Entech Europe. The timing is so important, and that's really where I saw God's handiwork, because this building in Dubai, we'd won that competition. It was the Etisalat Tower in Dubai, big ball on the top. It had stopped. It had been frozen, because they wanted to do one in Abu Dhabi as well. So we didn't have as much work. The company had dried up a bit. Work was there, and it was in abeyance. It was waiting. And the week after I took over, there was something like 7 projects released. And so the staff were thinking, he really knows what he's doing. You know, and one of the guys, he came into me, he was a Indian guy, great, very good architect when it came to construction detailing, a very competent chap, and came into me one day and he said, if I was you, he said, I'd go down to Dubai and buy one of those raffle tickets. I said, why is that? He says, because you're really hot on winning stuff at the moment. So your luck's in, he'll go for it. But I appreciated what he was saying, and I wasn't sure that would have been of the Lord. But this was what we needed to keep us afloat.
The scale of what you were now moving into, how many employees did you have, Philip?
At that time, it was probably about 120.
And you grew that to 400, is that right?
400, yeah.
Where your costs each month were $1 million, is that right?
The salary bill alone was over $1 million per month. I remember it when it hit the $1 million, thinking, you see, there were Emirati dirhams, and was that real money or not? Well, of course it is. If you bounced a check, you would know that it was real money, because they didn't have bankruptcy laws. They'd come and put you in jail. So there was always that, where's the safety net if this goes wrong? You really have to trust the Lord without question. Yeah, over $1 million a month. Then about 2008, there was a crash almost kind of worldwide. The property market, it started in the US and the ripples came along to the UK, and they went as far as Dubai. And a lot of people were buying property in Dubai, and to a lesser extent, Abu Dhabi. Dubai had opened it up for foreign investment, and a lot of that stuff stopped, and a lot of people went to the wall. That was a difficult time to manage. We hadn't been overexposed in Dubai. Our largest project at the time was one in Abu Dhabi, and we were part of a consortium, and the construction budget was about $2.3 billion or thereabouts. That kept us going through a very difficult period. I think it's a bit like Moses, the ravens will come down, the manna will be there. Work seemed to come in the most unlikely places, and the Lord provided.
Yeah.
But it was still anxious.
Yeah. But what an adventure you've been on, Philip. What an amazing adventure. You've built an iconic skyscraper that Lego's now made because it's so iconic. What a journey that God took you on, and your recognition of God leading, guiding. You were prayerful. You were moving on the prompting of the Spirit, because I know a lot of the backstory. It's been an amazing journey. I know you've sold the company now and it's kind of shifted, but people that are listening to this, they may be thinking, wow, what are the key things for you that you would transfer to them that you've learned over this period? And now you're still investing, you're investing in properties in Ireland, you've invested in a church, because God's given you the privileged position to be able to do that with generosity and everything. But just give us some of the steps, because people may be listening to this and they may think, well, I can already identify as a 9-year-old. Well, Logan's not going to do anything. He's the last in the class. We need to give him more. And then to move from there, and what God did for you. It's been an amazing story of God's grace and provision and leadership. Give us some nuggets that you've learned, Philip, that we need to pass on to the next generation of entrepreneurs.
It's the long game. I remember at times feeling, what are we going to do next? I had acquired an elephant, but this elephant needs to be fed, you see. So we needed to constantly reinvent ourselves. I suppose for me, the business is like a life-giving organism. It's got people and who have got families, and there's relationships, and there's a whole host of really helpful things. And that's important. And we've got to look after that. And we've got to have a culture that the people who work for us, work with us, understand that, you know, it's not just about a business and making money. Cash flow is the lifeblood of the construction industry. We need that. But there's so much about a business that we should cherish and look after. And it's those relationships that we have with clients and relationships we have with each other. And the workspace is a safe place. It's a good place. It's somewhere where you want to come and give off your best. And those values are in the gospel.
Yeah.
That's about it, really. Solomon asked for wisdom. So we need to know what to ask of the Lord. And I think that's key. That's key as well.
And I'm sure when you're living with the kind of decisions you were having to take most days, I'm sure your prayer of Solomon and asking for wisdom was a key part of your leadership within that.
Yeah, it was. I remember when 2008 hit and we were able to carry on at full steam till 2009, and then that big project in Abu Dhabi, they turned off the taps and that came to an end. I had 7 landscape architecture projects that we had from the municipality, and I thought, well, at least we have this to fall back on. And then the letter started to come in and say that that was drying up too. And, you know, when you have over $1 million a month on staff, you've got to cut, you've got to be realistic. And it was so difficult to have built this thing up and then to start to dismantle it or take it back. Those were difficult situations. And I remember one week I had to let 50 staff go, and a lot of people were coming in with horror stories about their mother having cancer back in India. Why won't you let someone else go and keep me? And I would have dearly loved to have kept everyone, but we can't live everybody else's lives. And if I don't say some people have to leave the boat, we're all going down. You know, that was difficult. But I remember I kept my door open, and by the end of the week, I was getting pretty tired of some of the excuses. And people, they're hurting, so they like to hit out. But I remember at the end of the week, and I had a very good, very godly administrator, Indian guy, and he said to me this day, he said, "Mr. Reddy has come to see you, sir." And this would have been the equivalent of our Friday afternoon. And I thought, I've had enough. I don't want to see him. Because I knew that Mr. Reddy, he'd got his letter to go. And I thought, I can't take it anymore. The administrator said, "But he's been here to see you since the morning." I had to listen to him. I had to listen to Mr. Sibby Thomas. Brilliant man, because he had wisdom. And he lived a very good and righteous life. Not of the same particular Christian faith, but you had to recognize godliness in other people. And so I thought, if Sibby is impressing upon me to see this man, I should see him. So in comes Mr. Reddy, and I'm thinking, "Oh, Mr. Reddy, how are you?" And he comes and he shakes my hand. I thought, well, that's a good start. And he said, "Sir, I've just come to say thank you." And I thought, some of these people can't read the English letters, you know. And I'm thinking, maybe he has understood. He's been fired, you know. And so I said, "What are you going to do now, Mr. Reddy?" He said, "Oh, I'm going to go home, sir. I'm going to go home to India. Maybe I'll get a job, maybe I'm not." And I thought, my goodness, he does understand. And why is he thanking me? And I looked at him and I said, "Well, that's good news." He said, "Yes, sir." And he realized. He said, "No, I've just come to thank you, sir, because you don't owe me a penny. You have kept me on, sir. Because of you, sir, I have been able to finish building my house. I've sent my 2 boys to university in Canada. And you, sir, I know when the client didn't pay for my services on site, you did and you kept me." He said, "So you don't owe me anything, sir. Thank you so much." Wow. And that was the equivalent of our Friday night. And I just thought the Lord sent him in. There are things we have to do that are very difficult, but the Lord is gracious.
God gave you a little bit of a special person on that Friday afternoon, which made you remember the impact you'd had on those people's lives, which is a privilege and a responsibility. Philip, we're coming into land here. You're now back in Northern Ireland. You're now investing in other entrepreneurs and trying to give them some lessons, some insights. You're giving more to your Christian faith and generosity and all of that. What a journey that God's been on with you. And he's not finished with you yet, sir.
Yes, I've been given a few words to that effect. So good to hear it again.
I know we're linking with you in Northern Ireland and everything's there, but your entrepreneurial journey, moving to big scale buyouts, all of that, the one overriding thing that you've shared with me today is the Lord is interwoven in all of that business and all that you've done and all that you, the good times, the bad times. He's kind of been the glue and the thread through it all. Philip, it's been a real pleasure. I mean, I know we've got a lifetime and I've just pulled out some nuggets of what you've done. But thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Gospel Entrepreneurs in partnership with UCB. Philip, you're a star, and it's been amazing what God has used you to do and the influence that you have had. It's absolutely phenomenal.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
God bless you.